Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 483, an interview with Daniel Hopsicker. This is being recorded on October 31st of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Daniel Hopsicker, the author of, among other titles, Welcome to Terrorland, Mohammed Atta and the 9/11 Cover-Up in Florida. Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Pleasure to be with you. Happy Halloween.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's a day when people are imitating or thinking about spooks, and in your book, you talk about spooks of a very, very different type. And we're going to be talking about some of these operations through which the September 11th hijackers in Florida appear to have infiltrated the country, and which certainly provided them cover. Before we get into the hijackers per se, one of the elements that you cover in your book is an apparent attempt on George Bush's life on September 11th. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about that.
Imagine my surprise. Okay.
Okay.
That was my. Feeling about it when I discovered it. And I discovered it. I mean, it wasn't, no one slipped it in. There were two separate news reports the day after September 11th, or several days after. One on a local Sarasota TV, one in a local Sarasota newspaper, which when put together, clearly indicated to me that someone tried to kill George Bush at 6 a.m. To begin September 11th. The evidence was inescapable, and yet I couldn't credit it, you know, because I couldn't imagine a situation in which, if that had happened, he would not have made as much public relations hay out of that as he could. So as I examined it, and I'll lay out for you the basics of what each report was, and let you draw your own conclusions. I realized, if it was true that four Arab men in the white van tried to kill George Bush to begin September 11th, then whatever really happened September 11th, is probably a lot different than anything I've even imagined.
Okay, if you tell us about how that apparent attack or attempt was carried out. Who was involved? What was the methodology?
Well, let me tell you. Look, I found two reports. Okay, I was operating on when I got to Venice on a friend's cynical dictum that the only real news you get in anything big is in the first 24, 48, or 72 hours, and so I examined. Closely, I examined everything that was printed about September 11th in the local newspapers here in Southwest Florida afterwards. And then I turned my attention to what had been aired on TV, and that was where I found the first story. The local NBC affiliate in Sarasota, their investigative unit headed by a young reporter named Monica Yadov, discovered that a Sudanese man had made a credible threat to the life of George Bush the night before the morning of September 11th in Sarasota, where Bush was staying. Okay?
Okay.
A man had gone first to the Sarasota police, and they immediately turned him over to Secret Service. And the Secret Service raided three locations and took a whole bunch of people into custody. And the people they took into custody, news reports then said, were a half a dozen Sudanese nationals. Well, you have to picture Sarasota, Florida. It's a lot like, say, Saratoga in Silicon Valley, okay?
Okay.
A half a dozen Sudanese nationals. What were they doing in Sarasota? Pricing retirement real estate, looking to buy Catherine Harris's old voting machines. It was just like completely, amazing that had indeed been the case. But news reports, the AP did a story on it. Said, they took these people into custody, and one of them had gone. To the Secret Service with the report of fears of an attack on the U.S. and on the president, but that the Secret Service had ruled that it had all been coincidental, had nothing to do with September 11th.
Well, obviously that strains credibility.
You think? Do you think, Dave?
Well, you know, don't quote me on that, but it certainly seems a little strange to me.
And to her credit, it seems strange to local NBC reporter Monica Yadoff. And she tracked down the people that had been taken into custody and learned that they reputedly belonged to the Sudanese Liberation Front. You know, Sudan is in a perpetual civil war,
right,
between the Arab Muslims and the Christian animists and God, you know, and whatever else they have. And so apparently there were a good half dozen people in that outfit in Sarasota.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked out loud why that might be, the answer came back that foreign guerrillas had been trained here, and this part of this little stretch of Florida had been used in covert operations since before the Bay of Pigs.
We'll get into some of those historical links. Time permitting, if we have time
they lead right up to Porter Goss.
Because
the island, Yusepa Island, is where they trained the Bay of Pigs guys,
mm-hmm.
which is right next to Sanibel Island, where Porter Goss moved in 1970. And Yusepa Island today is a private island, the richest private island in the country.
Dan, you know, let's touch on Porter Goss for a second, then I want to revert back to the
sure.
subject of this apparent attempt. On your website, you have a picture that was taken in Mexico City a few months before President Kennedy was killed, and there's some very, very interesting people at this particular gathering. One of them appears to be Porter Goss. I wonder if you'd flesh that out for us and tell us who some of the other notable personages were at this particular soiree.
Oh, wow, well, that's a whole story. I discovered I spent 2 years writing a book about CIA pilot and drug smuggler Barry Seal, and I had access to Seal's own archives, which had been combed through in 1995, I learned, by a 7-person State Department detail, but they had not gone through the contents of the widow Seal's safe. And in that safe, one day, when she was just showing me remembrances, okay,
mm-hmm.
She pulled out this picture, a nightclub picture, you know, the kind, you know, they take in a nightclub and then, you know, you want, give you a copy of it later for $10, right?
Sure.
And it had been taken in a nightclub in Mexico City on it said the little label, on January 21st, 1963. And in the picture were 10 men, well-dressed men in black suits and skinny ties, celebrating something, clearly,
mm-hmm.
Having a laugh, having a night out. And I discovered very quickly, because it's obvious, that this was a photograph of the CIA super-secret assassination squad, Operation 40.
Right.
And identified four of the 10 men, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was positive enough to ID in my book, Barry and the Boys, and those four were Felix Rodriguez, who's sitting front left. That was unmistakable.
And of course, Felix Rodriguez is an anti-Castro Cuban who was a veteran of everything from the hunting of Che Guevara through the Iran-Contra imbroglio.
Yeah, Felix is one of the boys.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So Felix is in the picture. Then there's another guy I wasn't able to ID, and then there's Barry Seal, a chubby-looking 24-year-old daredevil pilot, Barry Seal.
Right.
On the other side of the table is unmistakably William Houston Seymour. Now, I don't know William Houston Seymour from Adam, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I had to read through the assassination literature and discovered that the bulk of, you know, the serious researchers seemed to believe that William Houston Seymour had been used to impersonate Lee Harvey Oswald you know, to set up a legend for him at least a few places.
Yes, and by the way, for people not familiar with the Kennedy assassination investigation, during the time when the real Lee Harvey Oswald, it's like I've got a secret, right, was in the Soviet Union, there were people impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald and doing various things that would help to create the legend all over the American Southwest. Go ahead, Daniel.
Right, and they said this was one of those guys.
Yep.
Okay. And sitting next to him is Frank Sturgis.
Yep, Frank Sturgis, of course, a Watergate burglar, and once again a veteran of what Nixon termed the whole Bay of Pigs thing. At that time, calling himself Frank Fiorini, though. Okay.
So I had hit pay dirt, okay?
Uh-huh.
And the first person I showed the photo to was a man who was involved in intelligence in and out with Barry Seal since 1964 in Laos.
Okay.
And he almost leaped out of his skin. You know, he did everything but demand a negative, which I'm sure he would have if he thought he could have. It was amazing to see the reaction. There weren't supposed to be any pictures.
Sure.
There weren't supposed to be any pictures. But there it is. And that is a, you know, that's my contribution. And I think if you know, that's a big chunk of America's secret history in one snapshot.
It is, and I wouldn't sell yourself short. You made an awful lot of other contributions, not the least of which is Welcome to Terrorland. But I would simply note in passing for the listeners that with the controversy about the outing of Valerie Plame, Joseph Wilson's wife and a CIA covert operations officer, there is a great deal of rancor between the CIA and the Bush administration. One wonders whether perhaps Porter Goss, a person who at least circumstantially, not only as a matter of record, a former CIA officer, quote, former, unquote, CIA officer, but somebody who quite literally probably knows where the bodies are buried, was put in there in order to perhaps ensure that George Bush doesn't become one of those bodies, politically or in point of fact. Daniel, let's jump back now to the
right, okay, so
fight.
We've got a report on NBC about a credible attempt to the country and the president delivered to the Secret Service in Sarasota, where Bush is, the night before the attack.
Right.
The Secret Service takes it seriously enough to raid four locations, pull in a bunch of people that were never seen again, and then say it was all totally coincidence. There was nothing there. Please move along. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had a story in the local paper that placed the first story I've just told you in a whole different light. And this story, God bless local people, okay? You know, local cops, local firemen, you know, the people that aren't in on the joke that they're supposed to keep their mouth shut, okay?
Right.
This was, you know, remember, so the night, this was just a local fire captain who had apparently been asked along by Bush for his morning jog with the entourage. They jog at 6 in the morning. He's at the Colony Resort on Longboat Key. This is the fire captain on Longboat Key. So he shows up at 6 in the morning, and he's there when an extremely curious incident happens that in hindsight becomes, you know, pretty amazing. Four Arab men in a white van pull up to the guard shack in front of the hotel, identify themselves as Arab journalists, there for a 6:15 interview around the pool with Bush after his morning jog. That's been set up for them by, and he gives the name, they gave the name of a Secret Service agent.
Mm-hmm.
The Secret Service agent at the guard shack, bless him, sensed something and refused them in access, but giving them the number to call in Washington to get access. In other words, the Secret Service guys, you know, wasn't going to let him in because they didn't have access, but he wasn't sure they weren't who they said they were, so he gave him a number, you know, a PR number at the White House to call, you know, to try to set something up for them.
Sure.
That's the story. They turned him away, and it turns out that the exact same ruse had been used 2 days earlier on September 9th to assassinate the head of the Northern Alliance, probably the Taliban's chief foe in Afghanistan, Shah Massoud.
Mm-hmm.
So this can't be coincidence. It beggars the imagination that this was not a credible assassination attempt. And that had they gained these four Arab men posing as journalists gain access to the Colony Beach Resort, they'd have blown George Bush the kingdom to come.
And it's revealing that that one among many, many of these Florida connections that you've been investigating really has not received much distribution at all. Daniel Ian, welcome to Terrorland. You focus on the flight schools that were used to train many of the hijackers. As we mentioned last week, those flight schools were run by the two Magic Dutch boys, Rudy Deckers and Arnie Krutoff, in turn apparently working as something of a cutout or minions for a guy named Wally Hilliard, who we'll go back to. We mentioned last week that there were a lot of irregularities with regard to what these guys did, and I'd like you to flesh out just how far out of the baselines these guys were able to run, both with regard to their business practices and flaunting FAA regulations, because it'll give our listeners, I think, an idea of just how extraordinary this whole situation was, and they should bear in mind that it is these flight schools and these operations through which Mohammed Atta and apparently a number of the other hijackers were basically infiltrated.
Dozens. They trained dozens of terrorist pilots at just a few facilities.
Right.
And the first indication that an operation took place here is just the flat out fact that in 1999. Arab men began streaming into Southwest Florida for flight training. It became a flood in the year 2000 and 2001. So they went from like 5 Arabs at local flight schools to 500 to 1,500. All right? Those are numbers, okay? Well, Rudy Deckers alone trained over 500 Arabs, okay? The first thing to know about these guys is that they are not operating a business, okay? That's, if I could put one thing out there, Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Sheikh, he did not come to Venice, Florida to attend a flight school owned by Wally Hilliard and run by Dutch boy Rudy Deckers, because that was not a business. It was not a flight school. I can give you 100 different instances of why that is, but when someone is operating a store but cares nothing about selling, you know, whatever it is the store sells, you know, you can begin to become suspicious about whether that's its intended purpose or not.
And as we mentioned last week, too, several of these pilots, at least including Mohammed Atta, were already very experienced and therefore didn't need to learn anything. Go ahead.
Correct. So I scrutinized, because I am a business reporter, or once was, just business stories that had been written about Huffman Aviation, about Rudy Deckers, and about Wally Hilliard, and discovered that whatever it was doing, they were doing flight training wasn't it. For example, they bought their first flight school in Naples, Florida, were running it for 3-4 months, losing $40,000 a month, when they bought their second flight school in Venice. Already, see, if you're losing 40 grand a month on a flight school, why would you want to go buy another one? And when they went to buy the second one, they just walked in with a wad of cash and said, you know, what do you want? They paid well over book for the business.
In cash?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, it's nice work if you can get it, as the song says, and apparently they got it. Tell us some more about their business practices. How about their ability to pay rent?
Well,
one of the things you note is that
Rudy Deckers, the flight school could never meet its rent at the Venice airport and was late every month for 6 months until when they finally did pay their rent on time, it made the news in Venice.
And wasn't that right around the September 11th?
Yes, it was.
So in other words, they couldn't make the rent despite the fact that they were walking around with wads of cash, and yet all of a sudden around September 11th, suddenly they could make the rent.
And while they couldn't make the rent, while they were getting humiliating coverage in the local newspaper, flight school laid on rent again, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These two men were launching an air carrier, which was no more an air carrier than their flight school was a flight school. They announced Florida Air, and their partner in the venture was a real interesting guy from upstate Washington named Richard Bulkey, who, when I asked who's Richard Bulkey, I quickly discovered that he was just then participating in the $350 million looting of pension funds in Portland, Oregon.
Only $350 million.
Did you know that $350 million had been looted from pension funds in Portland? Did you remember big headlines on that?
Not off the top of my head.
Me neither, man. Me neither. And yet, just by looking up Richard Bulkey, right? I care about pension funds, right? I mean, you know, I discovered, my God, this guy was given $25 million to build a condo project that he'd only budgeted at 12.5.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go to apply for work like that?
Well, your book raises a number of questions as to possibilities if someone is so inclined. But one of the things that's striking is when you investigate Rick Bulkey's operations in the Pacific Northwest, there's a striking similarity between not only his airline businesses, but also some of the managed care facilities that he was involved with, and exactly what was going on clear on the opposite side of the country down in Central Florida. If you could tell us a little bit about the similarities between these operations, and listeners, as they listen to Daniel's account, should remember that the Magic Dutch boys, Rudy Deckers anyway, and Wally Hilliard, were going to be starting an airline with the fellow whose operations Daniel's about to describe. Go ahead.
Well, they actually did.
Yeah.
They actually did. And the interesting thing about it, and I think one of the things that makes their little airline really of interest, is that they launched... new service between two cities, and didn't sell one ticket. I mean, it's not just that, like, you know, there wasn't much business, okay?
Uh-huh.
They didn't sell one ticket. So, but they had planes around. So the planes must have been around for some reason, and it wasn't to, you know, to be flying businessmen back and forth to Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm. Again, if you did, because Rick Bulkey, apparently he had the same kind of an operation going on up in the Northwest, where he just he could basically break every rule of business and finance, and also like Deckers and Krutoff, they were basically wiping their feet with every FAA regulation around, or perhaps some other portion of their anatomy. But tell us a little bit about just how far out of the baselines, again, these guys were able to run. And then either near the end of this side or in the next half of our interview, Daniel, one of the people who did manage to fly Florida Air, this funkiest of airlines, was none other than Mrs. Harris's baby girl, Catherine.
Yeah, she gave him, they built a whole story around her endorsing the airline. Probably purely by accident, don't you think? But at the same time she was endorsing this little airline, they couldn't meet their rent month after month. So, I mean, do you think Catherine Harris is the kind of gal that dates guys that, like, can't pay their rent?
Not necessarily.
I didn't have that impression of her.
Uh-uh. Nope, not at all.
Rick Bulkey,
yeah.
Okay, owned Harbor Air. It was
right.
Called the Navy's airline. They ran back and forth between Oak Harbor, Washington, which is where there's a big Navy base. He got 60. It was mob-run unions that were pension funds that were busted out. Okay, so
right.
You ask yourself, well, you know, somebody's got to have some pretty, you know, brass balls to bust out a mob union. Who could do that? Well, I mean, it must be the mob itself, don't you think?
Certainly a very real possibility, although it's obviously in this entire filigree that we have, organized crime is obviously one element, but it's much more than that.
And a big one, because, yep. You know, I mean, if you're a secretary in one of these Teamsterish unions, you're going to have to work an extra decade because of the $350 million mm-hmm. that was looted. In order to, you know, get retirement benefits.
Right.
And that's not too cool, is it?
Not at all. Not at all. And Harbor Air, very strong parallels to what was going on in Venice, in that none of what was going on seemed to make any sense from a business standpoint, because it wasn't a business. Money was flowing out, and there really was no commercial viability of what was going on, at least on the surface.
Right. And people said that. People that worked for him said, we don't know what he was doing, which is what You know, I mean, one guy that knew him said Bulky owned retirement homes, pulled shenanigans, and got sued a lot. You know, he wasn't from the beginning. Here, his employees said from the beginning they felt that the finances flowed from the real estate holdings and the retirement homes into this aviation company, and that there was really no way this aviation company was really making money. So the question about what this aviation company was really all about still remains to be seen.
Obviously, what they were not doing was making money from flying people or car. Well, perhaps cargo, but not anything that would appear on a flight manifest per se.
Well, all I can tell you is that several witnesses to Bulky's aviation operations in Northwest Washington said the same thing that many witnesses said about Rudy Decker's and Wally Hilliard's flight schools. This guy said it was like they were only pretending to run a business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how much more do you need to hear than that?
Well, obviously,
they've got
not.
Lots of toys, though, okay? That's what makes these guys interesting.
Yep.
They can't pay their rent, but while Bulky's company was going bust, extravagantly bust, all he cared about, said an intimate of his at the time, was loading his Grumman seaplane with really fine wines for his excursions out into the islands.
Well, again, nice work if he can get it, and he apparently did. Daniel, we are almost out of time on this side. We'll pick up this fascinating narrative on the other end. And for listeners' benefit, remember, if it seems like we've gone a long way from September 11th, this is the milieu. This is the environment through which many of the key hijackers moved into the U.S.
This is the network, my friend, and it's not just me saying it. There's an FBI translator, whistleblower named Sibel Edmonds that talks about the State Department covering up a drug trafficking network associated with 9/11, and these are those people.
Yep, indeed. Daniel, we're almost out of time on this side. The holiday season is going to be coming up by the time many listeners hear this program. You've got a number of things that I would recommend as holiday gifts, including an especially Welcome to Terrorland. Tell us where people can get the book and also something about the DVDs and videos you have available.
Well, they should like come to the website, madcowprod.com, the Mad Cow Morning News, because we've got new stories there every week. And Welcome to Terrorland is the new book. Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida. And you can buy it on the website, or you can call the 800 number, which is 800-556-2012. Also, we're re-releasing the documentary I did while I was preparing the book called Muhammad Atta and the Venice Flying Circus. And we're adding 20 minutes or so, or maybe even half an hour, of my interview with Muhammad Atta's pink-haired stripper girlfriend, Amanda Keller, where you will hear, I mean, just in the regular tones of someone talking about, you know, stuff that happened to them, you know, what this guy was like.
And we will be visiting with Daniel Hopsicker on the other side of this program and fleshing out this underworld milieu through which the hijackers infiltrated. And, by the way, I want to note that I don't get any money whatsoever from Daniel's operations here. This is simply an act of citizenship. So.
You know what? I kind of don't either, you know?
I mean, I know the feeling.
It was a bad career move.
Yeah, well, I tell you, what you don't want to do is dovetail what you're doing with non-commercial radio. Anyway, this concludes Side 1 of For the Record, program number 483, an interview with Daniel Hopsicker, being recorded on October 31st of 2004. We'll be rejoining Daniel on the other side of this interview. My name's Dave Emery, and for Daniel Hopsicker, thanks for listening.